Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Cartwright. And our primary area of focus is the now dead 21 Magic side bet on the Buffalo blackjack games that were found in Colorado until recently. Cartwright, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks, it's good to be back.
In general, what was the 21 Magic side bet?
Okay, so that was a side bet on blackjack, where you get paid if you have a winning hand that totals 21. So there's a pay table, and the payout is based on the number of cards in your hand, where more cards equals a higher payout. So, for instance, if you get a natural blackjack, that's a 2-card 21, assuming it beats the dealer, then you would get paid 6-1 on your side bet, all the way up to a 7-card or more 21, got paid 25-1, so, which was nice. But, the key to that, though, is that it does have to be a winning 21. So if the dealer makes 21, it's a push.
Oh, that sucks.
And, a lot.
The amount of the side bet, does it have to be, was it a small limit?
Right.
Or could you bet as much as your initial blackjack bet?
Well, when we were playing, you could bet as much as your initial blackjack bet. So they had no limit on that. So
unfortunately, though, Colorado, the limits are only $100.
Correct. Yeah, so what we were doing was betting $100 on the main bet and $100 on the side bet. And we could play multiple hands. So that was nice.
Okay. Michael Shackelford, on his Wizard of Vegas site, posted a strategy based on an infinite number of decks rather than 6 decks actually in play. He also said it was a tough strategy to work out. How much of a difference does the number of decks make, and how hard did you find it to work out the strategy?
Okay, so first I just want to say it's an honor to have a mention on the Wizard of Odds website. I learned a lot from Shask's site, and I actually used it to verify a lot of my blackjack code when I was working on it. So super valuable site, and I really, really appreciate it. The strategy that he posted was actually done by a friend of his that goes by Crystal Math on the Wizard of Vegas forum. He's a gaming mathematician, and for the most part, we agree on the strategy. There were a few, small things that I disagreed with, but overall, the strategy that he posted was certainly a winning strategy. I chatted with Shaq about it a little bit, and as far as the struggles that he had analyzing it, I think my impression was that his code doesn't really lend itself to handling payouts where it's based on the number of cards in the hand. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's where he found some issue. For me, I've written my software to be as versatile as it possibly can. So I can pretty much handle any situation I want, varying amounts of information about the various hands at the table, that sort of thing. The trade-off there, though, is that my software is brutally slow. So it can take many hours to do a full cycle of blackjack with my software versus, I'm sure, with Shaq, it's very fast.
So are you doing combinatorial analysis?
Yes.
Or okay.
So yeah, so what I do in these situations is I do a full cycle. So I do a combinatorial analysis to get like the exact house edge, and then my software will actually generate a basic strategy chart and just output it, so I can paste that into a spreadsheet, and that'll color code it, makes it very easy. And then what I do is I write a simulator to then validate the combinatorial analysis and to try out various betting strategies if it makes sense for that game. So this game you just bet, but if it's a card counting thing, that sort of thing, I would go to the simulator to look at different bet spreads, that kind of thing.
Now, had you already worked this out when it appeared on Shaq's site, or did you see it on Shaq's site and then work it out?
No. So a good friend of mine who is a professional AP, he found the game and brought it to me. So he occasionally finds games out there and asks me to analyze them. So he asked me to analyze this. I did, and you know, it looked pretty lucrative. So went out and played it for a weekend there in Colorado, and I came home because I have a job, and it was around a week after we started playing it, I think, that the Wizard posted something on the Wizard of Vegas forum mentioning that he was going to do an analysis. And so we knew that the clock was kind of ticking, and Shaq kindly agreed to delay publishing a little bit, and in exchange we kind of worked together on validating the numbers and that sort of thing. So once he had everything pretty well nailed down, by that time the game was more or less toast. So it worked out fine.
Right. I just want to point out that this happens a lot, where people get mad when Shaq or someone else publishes a strategy, because now suddenly the few people who knew about the game are going to be negatively impacted. But those same people never give him any credit, him or anyone else who publishes this kind of stuff. They never give him any credit where they learned about a game that they didn't know about from reading it on his site, and then they go out and make money. It's sort of, well, those don't count. It's right. Only the ones that impact me negatively are the ones that count.
In fact, on his forum, somebody posted information about the game asking if there was a strategy in, I think it was 2011. So wow. The information was has been out there for many years that the game exists, and I guess nobody had really taken the time to actually analyze it until fairly recently. I was not the first, though. There were people that were already playing it, which is really how the information got to us. So somebody saw somebody winning and mentioned it to someone else, who went down the line that way.
That is a danger of just sort of being seen in a casino playing something.
Right.
Is a problem sometimes.
Well, when you're doing really well, sometimes it's a good problem, though, I guess.
Well, I don't know. If you're doing really well, you're going to have stacks of black chips and other colors in front of you. That can attract unwanted attention from the pit. Well, if it's your own table, the pit knows how well you're doing. But people walking by seeing purples or chocolates, well, or whatever they have.
Often the unwanted attention is worse coming from other APs than it is coming from the pit. Because if it's a game that's in multiple locations, the pit can bar you in that one casino. The APs that see you playing it and suddenly go out and try to play it as well can burn it out all over the United States.
Right. So my anecdotal evidence, though, from talking to dealers, is that the folks who were playing the game before us were not playing a perfect strategy. They seemed to be doing an approximation of the strategy that wouldn't have been quite so good. So I don't know how thoroughly they were playing it, and they certainly weren't playing it. They weren't grinding it. The stories that I heard was somebody was there a month ago or 2 weeks ago, that sort of thing. So I don't think we really stepped on anybody's toes that was relying on it for their sole income or anything like that. But
yeah, I think my suspicion is it would have been found quicker and burned out quicker if it hadn't been Colorado, where
exactly.
The limit's $100.
That's so. Exactly right. I think that was a major factor in the game lasting as long as it did without getting crushed.
And what did you figure the hourly win rate was?
I would say it was around 1,000.
1,000 an hour.
Yeah.
With some variance.
with a lot of variance.
Yeah.
Because you're hitting a hard 20 with six cards in it.
I did that many times.
And ending up with 30.
Right.
It's got to have happened a lot.
I can now say that I've done plus EV play where I ended up with an 8-card 30.
An 8-card 30.
Yes. Very unusual blackjack hand to have. But, yeah. But I also made a couple of... I mean, I think my favorite hand, I had a 6-card 19, so I hit, and I drew an ace. So I had a 7-card 20, and I hit, and I drew another ace. So I made a 8 card 21 with back to back aces. So I hit hard 19 twice and won.
Nice.
So we were mentioned earlier these stacks of chips in front of you. So it's got to be right to rat hole the chips. Did you do this with? Did you announce to the pit that you were doing it so they didn't? So the idea is you're not trying to pull one on them because they know what you're doing. Right. But you're trying. So how did you do this?
That's right. So, well, when I was first playing, some of the casinos their highest denomination chip was $100. So, in those casinos, it was. I mean, it was getting a little out of hand how full the pockets got, you know? And so I just had stacks of chips. There was really not a big way to avoid it and walked out with, you know, racked chips. But where there were $500 chips and then eventually $1,000 chips were introduced to our games, I put them in my pocket. And when the pit came over to count down the tray, I was very upfront with, you know, I have some chips in my pocket. If you need to know how many there are, no problem. I just don't want it to be so obvious that I have money in front of me. And they always thanked me and were super appreciative of my, you know, openness about that and never asked me to dig through my pocket and count it down or anything. So that was actually a big part of this play for me, was getting the pit to like me. That was a major goal of mine, and I feel like I succeeded.
And there were problems with other people who didn't adapt that same strategy, right?
Yeah, so there was a casino I was playing, and I saw the long walk from the pit coming my way, and I had a feeling what was happening, but he profusely apologized to me and said that he had to lower the maximum bet and asked me if I wanted a comp to the steakhouse, and it was very, very friendly, and I wasn't backed off at all. It was just lowered the bet. At the same time, there was a different player who was getting barred and flyered in the town for the same play. So the difference was, as far as I can tell, just simply attitude towards the casino employees. I think it went a long ways. I tipped a lot as well, like a lot.
$1,000 an hour, you can afford a little bit of tips.
You can, and what I discovered, the biggest or the friendliest casino there, their dealers are also floor people. That is sort of punishment to the new dealers that they have to floor because you make a lot more money as a dealer, and so
they don't pool tips.
They do not pool tips. And so by getting that information and finding out that there was a good chance the person dealing to me today would be a floor tomorrow, I felt it was even more advantageous to make sure that they liked me. And so, again, I feel like that worked out very well, and I had a very, very good attitude from all of the casino employees that I interacted with. They were, frankly, quite happy for me that I was winning, and I think that the same is true for my friend who was also playing.
Now, you said you a 7 card 21 paid 25 for one, or 25 to 1, I don't
know. 2-1.
And what did a 6 card pay?
10 to 1. 5 and 6 were both 10 to 1.
So
was there an 8 card payoff?
No, a 7 plus.
So would it make sense if you had a 6 card 21 to hit it?
If it was a soft 21 to hit going for the 7 card. It might have made sense. I didn't actually analyze that because Colorado has a law, apparently, that it is actually not allowed to hit 21. And so most of the dealers didn't know that, but many of the dealers did and kind of made a show of pointing it out to me to show me how smart they were. And I appreciated the information. So yeah, hitting 21 is not actually technically allowed in Colorado from what I have gleaned. And so it wasn't worth looking at. And that was one of the very few shortcuts that I have in my blackjack software, is that it does not look at hitting 21.
Oh, so it isn't totally flexible.
It's not
totally
flexible. I could take that out, but, you know, I went ahead and kept that one in.
So I want to go back to the player that had a bad attitude toward the pit and all that.
Sure.
Was he late to the party? And do you know where this player came from? How he
I do play
the game.
I mean, I don't want to. I don't know how much I can get into it, but for the most part, this is one of the people who was responsible for getting it known to me that this game existed. So, so not a bad guy at all, but just not, my understanding was, and I don't know him, but my understanding was that the way he handled himself lended it, him to getting fired.
So it was a social skill
function. Social skill.
Now, you told me somebody brought the game to you. If somebody you didn't know wanted to you to analyze a game for some fee, is that something you do? And if so, how do they get in touch with you?
I do. So just like this friend, and there are a number of other folks out there who come to me when they see a game and would like some analysis done. Probably the easiest way is by getting a hold of you guys, if you don't mind. That's a great way to...
gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com.
There you go. Just, I'm sure Richard will be able to forward any inquiries over to me. And, you know, if I find it's an interesting game, I'm definitely willing to take a look at it.
Does your program have enough flexibility to analyze new video poker programs?
No.
Oh, damn. Okay.
But you don't just do blackjack. We should make that clear. Yeah, just right. Table games in general.
So far, I've stuck with just table games. Poker-based games, Baccarat-style scored games, blackjack games. I have I have libraries for those things. I haven't looked at video poker at all, but it's really, I mean, sort of a single-deck poker game, so... I could.
Until you get to games like
Ultimate X.
Ultimate X is. I looked at it, kind of tilted my head, and decided I wasn't going to go any further than that.
And they've gotten extra levels of difficulty on bonus on Ultimate X,
even with the streaks and everything else.
The streaks and even spin poker. Ultimate X has its
great
unique features. So the strategy is unusual. For example, sometimes you split eights and sometimes you don't. Blackjack players are used to always splitting aces and eights in basic strategy anyway. But here, that's not a good.
Right.
And is there a explanation, a dummy-proof explanation or something as to...
Sure. Well, so some of the strategy deviations, I'm not entirely sure why they're correct. The first version of the game that I analyzed, I didn't know that a push was... Dealer 21 caused a push on the game. So the first time I analyzed it, I was
way
extra
off.
Excited because the difference in EV is dramatic. And under those scenarios, you do always split eights and always split sevens.
Do you get, does the 21 bonus apply to split hands?
Yes. So when you, if you have two tens and you split, you have to post a blackjack bet and a side bet. So you've got a total of four units in play with a split hand. And so basically it's just a matter of there are some scenarios where the extra EV that you're getting by splitting is counteracted by this push on ties, and so that extra side bet makes the split not worth it. Fives, for instance, you just don't split. So instead sometimes of having two hands that start with five, you're better off having a hand that starts with that.
Well, sometimes 10. You'll double it.
You will double it. You'll treat it as a 10. Yeah. Yep. So any six card hand, though, you always hit if it's not 21. So that 25-1 payout basically trumps everything. And it kind of varies from there. 18 is probably the trickiest one. Hard 18 has different strategy based on the number of cards. It's still fairly simple. I mean, the strategy is almost hit until you have 21. It's really close to that. But there are a few variations. The splits in particular. Soft hands are all hits, including soft 20.
But not soft 21.
But not soft 21.
Does this game still exist, or is it completely dead?
So the last I heard, so the first time I went there, I physically saw it in almost all of the casinos there in Black Hawk and Central City, I think it's called. And my understanding is that most of them don't have it anymore. And the ones
and it was
that,
only in one state? I mean,
it was, as far as I know, it was only in Colorado, and with one exception, only in that town. Hmm. And so
I heard it was in Cripple Creek as
That's the exception, yeah. And so most of those casinos, as far as I know, have removed the game. And the ones that haven't have either limited, put a max bet on it that's very low, or did what the distributor actually recommended, which was limit the side bet to 20% of the main bet. Based on some messages that I got from Shaq, I think that the game distributor knew of the vulnerability from the beginning and may or may not have told the casinos to limit to 20% of the blackjack bet. If they did, the casinos ignored it. If they didn't, then I'm sure the casinos are pissed. But
is that a lawsuit in the making?
I don't know. That would be pretty fun. I would like to hear about that. I wish it would be fun to say that I caused that. But in any case, yeah. So we did the strategy, though, with no cover play. It was a matter of it's not worth it to try and hide what we're doing, because it was pretty obvious that we were just chasing the 21. And for the most part, dealers had seen it before or heard about it happening before. And so they were generally kind of excited to deal the game because it was a completely different than a normal, mundane, boring blackjack game. So they thought it was fun to always hit 17, that sort of thing.
And and their tips were pretty good when you were at the table.
The tips were very good. Yes. There were a couple of dealers in particular where I had very good results that, I mean, you know, they walked away with hundreds of dollars for their down. So, but, you know, again, I think it was worth it.
All right. You talked about hitting hard 19 twice with aces. It seems like a side count of aces might have been useful. Did you explore that? Did you use that?
Mm-hmm. I did. So I did the effective removal for the game to determine, you know, what removing one card of each rank would do to the edge. Aces were by far the most valuable card. I mean, it wasn't even close. So the fact is, though, that I didn't want to slow the game down, and it was worth a lot without doing anything extra. When I played the double deck games, there was some paying attention to depletion of aces, and what I generally did was vary the number of hands I was playing. Like, I would reduce down to one hand if aces were light. But I'm sure there's some sort of count or ace side bet, side count that you could have done that would have eked out an extra percent or two. But for the most part, I think we were more limited.
So instead of $1,000 an hour, you might make $1,010.
Exactly. Yeah. I think we were going to be more limited to the casinos stopping us from playing than anything else. Like, the hourly EV was great, sort of no matter what. Yeah.
Is that with one hand, or would you have to have all six spots or seven spots to get $1,000?
So my friend played all six or seven spots for a while, but especially with splitting tens, it slows the game down a lot because the dealers actually would run out of room, and which happens because, I mean, it was the highest variance play there. It was for sure the fact that, you know, I'm splitting tens four times, you know, and always end up bust all four, and that kind of hurts. But so I was limiting myself to four hands at most. So I was varying anything from one hand to four hands. And when I first got there, I was betting a little bit smaller, thinking that a $75 bet would get less attention than a $100 bet because it's not table max. But, you know, in the end, we sort of abandoned that theory.
It's also slower.
It's also much slower.
Yeah.
Watching the dealers try to figure out 9 times 75 was... And it was interesting. For the most part, one of the things that I did... And
you just correct the errors in one direction and let them go the other.
Well, actually, you know what I did is, for the most part, I corrected the errors in both directions and made sure that the floor saw me do that. And I established a lot of trust with the pit. And, I mean, on a couple of occasions, the pit actually told the dealer, do whatever he says. We trust him. It's fine. You don't have to call it out. So they were making fairly large payouts without getting any floor approval or anything like that, because they were happening fairly often and the pit trusted me.
So you're playing three hands and some stranger comes up who thinks this is a regular blackjack game. This is going to slow down. And how did you do anything to nicely encourage them to go find another table?
I absolutely did. So what I would do is I would try to find tables that were empty before I sat down, if I could. And I consciously didn't want to make anyone mad. I didn't want to make any other players mad, because dealers don't like to deal with pissed off people. The floor doesn't want to have their regular customers mad at some stranger. And so if somebody did come down to sit down, I would always warn them. I would say, look, I'm playing a little crazy over here. You should know that. And usually they would say, what does that mean? I would say, splitting 10s, hitting 17s. And they would say, okay, thanks for telling me, and get up and walk away.
Because clearly you would be bad luck for them.
Absolutely. I'm screwing up the flow of the cards for sure. And there were a few people that sat down and stormed off cursing at me. But there was also a group of people that said, you know, it's your money, do what you want to do, and sat down and actually got a lot of entertainment value out of watching my crazy play. And so, you know, there was kind of three groups of people: the people that didn't want to have any part of it, the people who thought it was interesting, and then the people that would really try to study what I was doing and then emulate it.
I was going to say, yeah. In many of these types of things, you get the followers,
yes.
Right, who want to...
My favorite followers, there were the ones that followed the strategy but didn't make the side bet. So there was a guy that decided it must be correct to hit hard 17 every time, but he wasn't making the side bet. So, you know, and I tried to very nicely let him know that, look, if, you know, you probably shouldn't play the way I'm playing, especially if you're not making this bet. And he just didn't seem to mind. But there were a few people that just followed what I was doing. They decided to start making the side bet and more or less trying to play the strategy. And if they asked me what to do, I would say, you know, well, if it were me, I would hit. But, you know, it's your money. It's up to you. That's my kind of stock response to that. If it looked like they were winning a lot or betting big, sometimes I would just get up and leave, because, I don't know, it just didn't seem like it was a good idea to have a lot of, even in more attention on the side bet or the table or me or anything else.
Well, the other danger is the more that you help them, now it's like you're going to be stuck with a buddy every time they see you in the casino. So,
yeah, that's true.
I mean, I understand you're not wanting to sort of piss off the pit and stuff, but you're really costing yourself there too.
Yeah, well, so in the end, what we ended up doing was just getting reserved tables that, you know, it became a non-issue. But, you know, at the beginning, I didn't seem appropriate to ask for that and until I really felt like I had a relationship established. And so you just had to deal with people sitting down. It wasn't too bad, though. I mean, there were a couple of people that sat down with the intent to play the game as I was playing it. Other, I guess, APs or people that had heard about the game. From what I heard anecdotally, it seemed like the dealers were all talking about it. I think watching us win sort of sparked interest in the dealers, and so they were kind of getting together trying to figure out how to build up a bankroll and actually play. And so
that doesn't surprise me at all.
And so, you know, in that town, it seemed like it's kind of a small community, and it was actually a lot of fun for me. Like I became, I don't know, almost a pseudo celebrity there, in terms of some dealers came from a different casino and saw me there and came over and were talking, and they started talking very, very openly about the game. And actually, I saw Richard once kind of shut down a civilian that was about to correct something that she shouldn't have, and I sort of tried to channel my inner Richard Munchkin in terms of shutting down table talk that shouldn't be happening. And so, but yeah, it was it was interesting, and I think the timing of the play was such that it was about to go down whether it was my friend and I or not. Like, eventually it was getting known. The dealers were figuring it out on their own.
Yeah, there's some level of pain tolerance, right, where you're going to reach that amount. No one knows what that number is until after it's over. And
right.
So.
How big do you think the AP community was in Black Hawk at the end playing this game?
Well, so as I mentioned, based on what the dealers were telling me, there had been a few people that were playing it before I got there. And there was my friend and me. And there were a few other people that I saw that came in while I was playing, as I mentioned. But they were all betting. The people that I saw were betting pretty small. So I think they were more word of mouth, let's give it a try, $10, $15 type players. I don't know if very many full-time APs really caught wind of it in time to descend on the game. They weren't there when I was there, and I was there for at least three of the casinos essentially shutting it down. So
how many weeks of play did you actually get?
So I played one weekend, and then I went there the following weekend with the intention of not leaving until the game was gone, and I was there for, I think it was about a week and a half. Something along those
lines.
And
your partner was there that whole time.
So my partner, he is a full-time AP and fantastically good at it and able to sit and grind for 20 hours at a time and whatever it takes. So I was a pleasure to watch him work from a distance. And at the same time, I have a job and other obligations that pulled me away from the table on occasion. So I didn't get as many hours in as he did, but yeah, well, I did my best.
I'm guessing your day job pays a little less than $1,000 an hour, though.
A little.
So did the word did you guys like move from casino to casino, and did the word just sort of follow you from one to the next, or how did
yeah.
you?
So what I did the first weekend I was there, I actually avoided two of the casinos in order to preserve them for the next time I was there, and he played them. And so we kind of tried to not be in the same casino at the same time and spread the play out a little bit. By the end, though, it sort of all got concentrated on one casino. And so we ended up
Why that particular casino?
It was the only one still accepting $100 bets.
Oh, okay.
So because of that, we were both basically sitting at reserved tables in different pits and just grinding.
We're going to leave this game pretty soon. Do you have any unusual anecdotes from playing this game to share with us that you haven't shared already?
Sure. I mean, I think I've shared a lot of them. But, I mean, one thing I'll say is that I definitely feel like I either learned or had some lessons reinforced from this game, one of them being networking. You know, this friend of mine that found this game and sent it over to me, I met him at Richard's house, actually, at a party there. And so I think the value of networking, it proved itself very well to me. And also, as I mentioned before, I think being friendly to the casino and making sure that you establish yourself as somebody that is nice, that people like, is a plus EV move, at least generally speaking. And
in life as well.
In life as well, yeah. That's true. And, you know, I think as far as anecdotes from the game, we were talking about people following us around. I did have one guy who was kind of a fan. He showed up at like three different casinos that I was at on different days. And once he spotted me, he came to the table and he didn't play the strategy. He just sat and played table minimum and wanted to watch. And so, you know, that was kind of interesting. I guess the crowd reaction, people gathered behind me watching me play. And I mean, hitting a 20 and getting an ace gets a reaction out of everybody. And that happened to me a number of times. And so,
not as many times as hitting a 20 and getting a 10.
That's correct. That's true. But the dealers actually ran pretty good in terms of most of the time that I did that, I had a bet out for them. So they got the 25-to-1 payout as well. And so, you know, it was a good time. And I did hear a pit person say something that I hope someday I hear it again. The dealer like turned and explained to the pit that, you know, this game is broken. He's playing with an edge. And the pit guy said, and I quote, "I don't give a shit. Just let me know when to order another fill."
So, oh, yeah, that happens all the time.
So yeah, I mean, needless to say, I was very happy with the general attitude there for this game.
Was there a factor of timing for you personally insofar as when you learned about the game compared to when you had built your blackjack analyzer?
Yes, absolutely. So had the game come to me 6 months earlier, I probably would have had to pass on doing the analysis because I didn't have any blackjack software. And it just happened that I had decided that it was time that I had. The only thing I had previous to that was some code written to analyze some side bets, but nothing to really play blackjack, and splits in particular are a pain in the ass. And so I just happened to have recently decided to sit down and work it all out, and did that, and had been playing around with various games and situations, hole carding, this sort of thing, just to try to reproduce some of the published numbers out there to ensure that I was doing it properly. And I pretty well had all of that wrapped up, and a couple weeks later this game kind of came across my inbox. And so it really wasn't that hard to do. For me the biggest part challenging the analysis was probably removing the shortcuts that I had. Like previously my software didn't allow for hitting hard 20, for instance. I had to trim that one out. I had to trim out a lot of things that ended up slowing it down even further, but you know, we came to the right strategy, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, to me, those are some of the most fun games to play are the ones that are brand new.
Right.
You know, the game we played together, again, was a brand new game. Didn't last very long.
They typically don't, yeah, but yeah.
But yeah, that to me, that really is...
Yeah, me too. I think it's a lot of fun. And one of the things about this game that was especially interesting is that it was basically just a broken game. So there was no card counting or any other sort of advanced strategy or technique going on. It was just play this basic strategy chart and win. And so I actually had a sense for the first time what it must feel like to recreationally gamble in terms of, I'm just going to go sit down and play and have fun and not really use my brain to concentrate on anything other than making it look like I'm having fun. And so it was a different experience than most of the AP plays that I've done.
Well, good. We've been talking to Cartwright about the Magic 21 bet on Buffalo Blackjack. We're going to take a brief commercial, and then we're going to come back and talk to him about some AP moves away from the blackjack table.
South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In August, in the Summer Sizzling Seat giveaway, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 2 a.m. the following day, approximately 20 random players each hour will be awarded $100. Every Monday is Prime Monday, where Prime is the name of their sexy seniors, 50 years of age and older group. It includes a tournament, half-off dinner if you play with points, $4 movies, and half-off bingo. Week 3 of the free video poker classes, Wednesday, August 16th, will be 8-5 bonus poker quick quits, a 99.55% game that to me is a lot more interesting than regular video poker. A quick quad consists of a three of a kind, where the other two cards add up to the rank of the trips, like 99954, or 444 deuce deuce, or 333 deuce ace. There are a lot of strategy deviations you make while going for the quick quads. There will be one class only, beginning at noon. The class is in the Silverado Lounge, which is the first lounge you come to when you park in the garage. Everyone at least 21 years of age and older is welcome. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is 10-play Dream Card. Dream Card, 10 coin per line game, where periodically the fifth card on the deal is replaced with a Dream Card, which becomes the best possible card given the first four dealt. The Dream Card chosen by the computer is almost always correct, but there are a few cases where a better card could be chosen, and you're free to change it when it happens, or just because you want to. You end up with more Royals, Quads, and W2Gs on this game compared to regular video poker. On games like Jacks or Better, where Quads pay only $125, you get a lot of Dream Cards. On games like Triple Double Bonus, where Quads pay $250, $400, $800, $2,000, or $4,000, you get a lot fewer Dream Cards because they are worth so much more.
All right, we're talking to Cartwright. He's on before, and he talked about using credit cards in an AP kind of a way. Are you still doing that, and do you have any information for us?
I am. So, as I mentioned before, I think in our first show, I think the best way to approach that is to have a trip you want to take, plan it, find the airline that you want to take, and really target miles to do that. One of the things that you can kind of get into trouble with, I think, is get a little obsessive over it, and it can turn into a full-time job almost, which I have to admit kind of happened to me. And you sometimes will end up with a stockpile of points or miles, and I think one piece of advice is to try to avoid doing that because they devalue over time. So each of the airlines will occasionally change their program so that it takes more miles to fly to destinations, or they lower the number of seats available, this sort of thing. And, you know, scary things happen, like Marriott and SPG merge. So far, the SPG program hasn't really changed, but it could, and it's one of the best ones out there. And so it's probably not a good idea to stockpile points.
So I'm going to throw this at you. We didn't tell you about this ahead of time, but now that you said that, I'm planning a trip after the first of the year, Singapore, Thailand.
Nice.
And I should tell you that I applied for, what was the Chase Sapphire? The
Reserve.
One that everybody says is the best card. I got denied because I had, five and two. That's five cards in 2 years. Although, people should be aware of this. I got screwed because I was an additional signer on my wife's card. I didn't think that counted as me having applied for a new card. But it did, which is why I wasn't able to get that. So
the most reliable way to get around that is to go to a branch. Now, I went to the branch and I still wasn't approved.
I did the same thing. They couldn't.
Yeah, I didn't get it either. My wife got one, though. So.
Oh. Something. So I might be able to. Oh, so
well, the 100,000 bonus is gone. Okay. They've lowered it, and so I think there are probably better cards out there.
Okay, so can we talk about what I should do starting today?
So if you're going to Asia, so what you should do is, are you planning on? Is it important to you to fly business and first class, or is coach okay?
Coach is okay because I have to foot the bill for five of us.
I see. That's a lot of miles. Okay.
Yeah.
So coach is okay for them, and you and Nelly are going to be in the first class?
If we only get two upgrades.
Right.
You know.
So what I would do is I would look for what airlines you want to fly. So if you're going to Singapore, Singapore Airlines is wonderful. I mean, their first class product is really, really top notch. But even in coach, it's not too bad. So Singapore Airlines is actually a transfer partner for a lot of the different credit cards. And, I mean, hopefully I'm not giving you misinformation, so validate anything I say because this is off the top of my head. But I'm pretty sure that the Chase Ultimate Rewards will transfer to Singapore, and the American Express Platinum will also transfer. Hopefully that's not misinformation. And so what I would do is I would look to see how many miles it's going to take and start searching for availability now. If you're flexible with your dates, you will probably be able to find availability. I'm pretty sure Singapore is one where once you transfer the points, they have a time limit. I think they do potentially expire. I could be wrong on that. But what I would do is I would look for availability on Singapore Airlines. I would find the credit cards that are good they're have generic points that are transfer partners. So, you know, when you're doing travel credit cards, sometimes you'll have like an American Airlines card where the miles that you earn are American Airlines miles. But other times it'll be a generic. So Citi Prestige, American Express Platinum, the Chase Ultimate Reward Program. Those are all points that you can use to buy things through their portals or transfer to partners. So in your case, I would try to find points that will transfer to partners like Singapore Airlines. Japan Airlines is also nice to fly. And Cathay Pacific, if you go through Hong Kong, it's especially if you're flying in business or first class, Cathay Pacific is amazing. So I would look for the points that can transfer well and start planning as far ahead as you can. Because availability, especially if you're getting 5 tickets, is going to be limited. I did notice, like, the trip that we talked about before when we went on our honeymoon, availability was really restricted, and it wasn't until about a week before our travel dates that some seats opened up. So I had some backup seats on reserve, intending to snatch up anything that might have opened up, and it did, so it worked out. So, again, flexible travel dates is going to be key for that. I would also look at...
Your bride was flexible as to when the wedding was?
No, the honeymoon.
Honeymoon.
So she was very. She was very accommodating. First class on Japan Airlines and 5-star hotels will get you some points.
Lady, lovely lady. Bonnie and I liked her a lot.
Yeah, great. Yeah, she's fantastic. So one of the things I noticed as far as hotels go, a lot of the hotels in Asia are actually very affordable. And so it might not be worth spending a lot of your points on them. Now, Singapore might be different, but if you're going to...
Singapore, I have a brother who's got spare rooms.
Okay, so you're covered there. Japan is also can get very expensive. So there I would look for hotel cards and things. SPG, like I said, is a great... SPG is really interesting because when you have... American Express has an SPG card and a business one. And you can earn points, and they're good for SPG hotels. Now that they've merged with Marriott, you can do some transfers and get Marriott hotels. But they also have some transfer partners, so you can actually transfer to American Airlines at a 1 point SPG point to 1.2 American Airlines points if you transfer enough. And so because of that little bonus and stuff, I think SPG has a lot of value. But in your particular case, I think probably the Chase ones are good ones to stockpile for your trip.
Although the Chase ones are the hard ones for me to get.
Yeah, they're the hard ones to get. I don't know if you might also want to try the Chase Inc. business cards. Those sometimes might fall under different rules. I would give that a try. One of my favorite tricks right now that I've been doing because it's fun, because it requires a little bit of social engineering, there's an app that United has called the United Mileage Plus X app. And what it is it's an app on your phone that you can buy gift cards with. And you can put, for a lot of the places, you could put in an exact dollar amount for the gift card. So, for instance, if you're at Chipotle and you're going to buy Chipotle, you'd be better off going into the app, putting in $8.78 or whatever your total is, getting a gift card for that exact amount, spending the gift card. It's a digital gift card, so they scan the barcode. That way you get the multiplier from the Mileage Plus X app, and also it still codes as a food purchase. So if you've got a multiplier on your credit card, you're not giving that up. So it's a way to kind of double dip. And if you're doing something, like if you're buying stuff on Amazon or Home Depot is another good one, one of the things you can do is you can use the Mileage Plus app to buy a Staples gift card with your Chase Inc. Chase Inc. gets 5 times points at Staples. So you buy a Staples gift card, say for $100. You'll get 5 points per dollar for Chase. You'll get 5 United miles per dollar from the app. Plus, if you have the Chase United Mileage Plus credit card, you get a 25% bonus on that. Then you go to Staples. You use the Staples credit card or gift card to buy a Home Depot gift card. That's where it gets tricky, because they're not supposed to let you buy gift cards with gift cards. So you have to do a little bit of social engineering, but their system will let you do it. So if you can convince the cashier to do it, then you can do it. And then go onto a shopping portal to buy the Home Depot product and just say you'll pick it up in the store if you don't want it shipped. So you use a shopping portal to then buy your stuff from Home Depot or Amazon, and so then you get points from that or cash back from that as well. So it's a way to sort of parlay a bunch of different things that'll end up getting you, you know, 10 to 15% essentially of cash back. So
I'm guessing now we have our a log as to when different things are discussed. I'm guessing that some of the people are going to notice that that started, and I'm making a number up, 48 minutes and 7 seconds, and they're going to go back and listen to that two or three times. There was a lot of information in there.
Yeah. So, and, you know, despite that kind of complicated scenario, what I personally have done is decided I sort of have taken a little bit of a backseat on the point churning. I don't really do any manufactured spend anymore, but if I'm buying something that is expensive, I usually will either get a new credit card. Another thing that you should do is call your credit card companies up and tell them you want to cancel the card. And when you do that, they will transfer you to the retention department. And the retention department has bonuses that they can give you for staying a customer. So, for instance, I bought something the other day. It was, I think, $3,000. And so I called, and the retention department gave me $15,000 bonus miles if I spend $3,000 in the first 3 months. So the next day I did my single transaction and I got an extra 15,000 miles out of it. So that was something that didn't require a ton of effort. It was a single phone call, and you know, it's a nice bonus. So it's definitely something to keep track of.
Is that mostly airline cards that do that, or?
No, all the cards will do that. Like every card will do that.
Well, so I had the United Premier, whatever that card is. I think it's Chase
United Mileage Premier. Plus. Yep.
Yeah, and when the time came that the annual fee rolled around, and I called up and said, you know, I was thinking about canceling it, blah, blah, blah. They were like, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, they didn't.
They don't like you very much.
I guess. Maybe I had too many Chase cards.
Well, so on my last was actually with Citi. So I have two Citi cards that both gave me a very nice retention bonus. And I've heard of folks getting pretty good bonuses from American Express. I don't know that I've really tried a lot with Chase. So maybe they're a little...
Were those Citi cards? Because I had a Citi card, too, that, again, the first year they waived the fee.
Right.
Are you paying the fee, or did you get them to waive the fee?
I'm paying... Some of the cards, I pay the fee. Other cards, what I do is I downgrade to a card that does not have a fee.
Okay.
One of the things I try to avoid is canceling a card, because when you cancel the card, your amount of available credit goes down, so it can actually hurt your credit score. And also, when you're applying for a card, sometimes you'll get denied, and if you call them, you can move credit around. So let's say you've got a Citi card with a $30,000 limit, and you're trying to get a new Citi card, and for some reason you're denied, you can call them up and say, well, if you'll approve me for the card, we can just move $15,000 over from this other card. And they will actually do that, because from their eyes, they aren't extending you any additional credit.
Right.
So that's sometimes a way to get through any restrictions that they have. At some point, you know, I have over $100,000 of available credit across my Chase cards, which means anytime I apply for a Chase card, it's going to trigger a review, because, you know, it's a lot, and they just want to make sure that I'm not a bad credit risk for them. And so sometimes it's easier to just say, well, just move something over. So I would avoid canceling cards, but for sure, some of the annual fees are outrageous, right? It's $450, $550 is what American Express Platinum has gone up to. So in those cases, unless you're getting value from all the extra perks, you should probably downgrade those.
And they treat a downgrade differently than a cancel.
Right. So from your credit report perspective, you have the same amount of credit available from that bank, so it doesn't really impact your score. And from the bank's perspective, they're still extending you that credit, so you have a credit line that you can kind of play around with. If you cancel, then the number of open accounts on your credit score goes down, the amount of available credit goes down, and the percentage of utilization goes up, and those are all bad things for your credit score.
Very good. We've been talking to Cartwright about both a blackjack game. And before we leave, I have another question about the blackjack game.
Okay.
I heard a number somewhere around 7% advantage on that game. Was that just on the side bet? Because hitting hard 17s can't be any good towards the main blackjack bet. That has to, right. You must be losing 2, 3, 4% on the main blackjack bet to get it. So is it 7% on the total amount bet, meaning like 15% on one and minus 6 on the other? Or was it, how did that work?
Okay, so you're right that the main blackjack bet, I think I looked at it and it was somewhere around negative 13% with the strategy that we were playing. So, but the 7% advantage would be based off of the total action for as a single unit. So what I mean by that is if I bet $100 on the blackjack bet and $100 on the side bet, my EV for that total action would be about $7. So it would be 7% of the $100 unit.
But
that's total.
So it'd be a 3.5%
no
advantage total.
Cause you well, 3.5% if you consider your unit to be $200.
Your element of risk.
Element of risk. There you
3.5%,
go. 3.5%. Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you split, so now you have 400 out there.
Well, but that's included.
Well, yeah, that's all included. So that 7-point-whatever percent that the edge was, that was assuming you were playing perfect strategy and it was per unit, and I considered the blackjack bet one unit and the side bet one unit. But if you're doubling down, splitting, whatever else, that's all kind of rolled into that.
Very good. Enjoyable show today. Thank you very, very much for being here. It was fun. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.